A couple of weeks ago, something happened to me. Maybe you read about it, maybe you didn't. I'm not going to get into it. But what I will get into is how that experience granted me the opportunity to analyze literally thousands of hateful messages and try to draw some conclusions from them. With this mountain of data, I was able to distinguish certain unique patterns in behavioral norms online, the sociology of a certain kind of social media user, and most interestingly to me, the root of some of the most common anti-Jewish racism being spewed on our screens. Now, some of the hate I got was your tired, run-of-the-mill racism. The K-word, what size oven fits your head, which was a weird way to phrase that. You people are an effing cancer on Earth, etc., etc. Not so interesting. Also got a lot of Nepo Baby, which I only mention because it's really fun to say. Nepo Baby. If I had a band, I'd call it Nepo Baby. Anyway, also not interesting. But what was interesting was the most common type of hate speech I received, which was a variation on a single theme. Zionist scum, Zionist trash, Zionist pig, dirty Zionist, Zionist Nepo Baby. Okay, I'm done, I swear. The sheer volume of these Zionist as insult DMs, plus something my friend Sarah Hurwitz said on an earlier episode of this show, helped me understand something I hadn't fully grasped until now. Something that I know most Jews do not yet understand. We continue to bang our heads on the tree, Charlie Brown style, shouting Zionism means self-determination in some part of the land to which Jews are indigenous. Don't you get it? First of all, no, they don't get it. They're not listening to us at all, either because no one they know or follow is saying that, or because they shut out anything counter to their already chosen belief. Thus, when these anti-Israel haters continue to use Zionist as an insult anyway, we wrongfully assume that they are doing so as a code word for Jew, as a slur, as a way to get shots in without getting tagged for it. And while the evil leaders who disseminate the anti-Jew, anti-Israel propaganda absolutely are doing this, the vast majority of people, that is, the useful idiots, are not. Remember, they're idiots. More kindly, these are not folks admired for their superior critical thinking skills. There's no subterfuge going on here. What's happening is that they have had a very different and very specific definition of Zionism implanted in their brains. If you ask most Zionist scum DMers if they hate Jews, I guarantee you, you'd get, "What? Of course not. I love Jews. My friend is a Jew. I'm a Jew. My doctor's a Jew. I'm very nice to him." First of all, you can love an individual in your day-to-day life and still be a total bigot towards their group as a whole, but that's another monologue. But that's not what's happening here either. A large swath of the global population has been carefully taught by social media, by elementary and middle and high school teachers, by their friends who learned it from their teachers or social media, and by tenured college professors, that Zionism means Israelis want to kill all Palestinians on earth simply because of who they are, their skin color, their not Jewishness. When you hear someone say Zionism is racism, and you think, but Jews aren't white and there are 2 million Arab Israelis, you likely conclude that this someone is either stupid or hates Jews. But in fact, they have been taught that Zionism is an evil on par with other racially motivated murder cults like Nazism or the KKK. This is what they've been taught, as verified by Sarah Hurwitz, who visited dozens and dozens of colleges. It is utter illogical, brainwashed ignorance, but it's not actually motivated by sincere bigotry towards Jewish people. Which doesn't mean that it's okay, but it's not the worst case scenario, and it's vitally important to understand precisely what we're dealing with so we can appropriately confront it. And we are dealing with folks who have been formally educated to believe that Zionism is evil incarnate. So of course they have no qualms about calling me Zionist scum or Zionist trash. Would you have qualms about calling an actual Nazi, Nazi scum or Nazi trash? Not only would you not feel bad, you'd feel good. And not just good, but righteous. You're serving justice to the very worst humanity has to offer. You, my friend, are on the right side of history. So how the hell do we fix this? How do we re-educate millions of people? To be honest, I don't think we can. I think in a lot of ways, our present is fucked. The deck is absolutely stacked against us. We are up against billions of dollars in foreign money that have been planting this seed for decades. We are up against an algorithm that cords us off into completely different realities. Let me give you an example. A few weeks ago, I participated in an amazing Passover-themed dinner with a ballroom full of Black folks, Jews, and Black Jews united in allyship, led by my friend Van Jones. And over dinner, Van recounted a story of the day the Bibas children were returned to Israel in coffins. As I'm sure most of you know, Van is one of our greatest allies and incredibly well-informed about the world. And he told me that when he asked a friend that day, who happened to be Jewish, why she wasn't returning his texts, she said because she was distraught over what was going on, he had no idea what she was talking about. Did she mean something about Trump had happened? Was it the economy? Guys, he had never even heard of the Bibases. The algorithm doesn't show them to him. Practically every Jew on earth was in a state of grief and trauma, shouting online, "Where is everyone? Where are my Black friends? Why is nobody speaking up for us?" It's because they literally had no idea it was happening. For a Jew, it sounds impossible to believe, but that is how the algorithm works. If you're not actually engaging, not just following, but engaging regularly with Jewish voices, and you bought a yoga mat one time so Meta thinks you're a liberal, you're just getting videos of dead Gazan children over and over and over, while Jewish pain is erased. And it works the other way too, right? Jews don't get those videos, and we also don't get videos about pain in the Black community or any other community either, unless we seek it out deliberately. And the result is that we blame each other for being bad allies, when in fact, we are all just being played. It is critical to understand how this works. So, how do you fight an algorithm? How do you dismantle or reform the billion-dollar apparatus of social media? How do you fight back against deep-seated academic brainwashing? There is no easy fix, and certainly not a fast one. Our opposition is going to take years. I'm not sure how we win the battle today, but I think we can win it in the next 10, 20, 30 years if we start now. Instead of Jewish donors putting their names on hospitals and theaters and sports facilities, we need to be investing in professorships and Middle East history chairs and Jewish study departments to counter the anti-Israel poison inside academia. We need to make Jewish day school financially accessible to every Jewish family to ensure that the next generation of young Jews are fully informed, confident in their strong Jewish identity, and cloaked in the dignity they need to face this fight on the front lines. We need to be showing up to school board meetings and state houses and town halls and playing a role in the shaping of our kids' curriculums. We need to be bringing educators like Project Shema or Mosaic Persuasion or Holocaust survivors to speak in our businesses and in our classrooms. We need to be sounding the alarm and getting to work, and we need to do it now. And lest you be discouraged, remember the Stonecutter's Credo, coined by 19th century social reformer Jacob Riis. When nothing seems to help, I go and look at a stonecutter hammering away at his rock, perhaps 100 times without as much as a crack showing in it. Yet at the 101st blow, it will split in two. And I know it was not that blow that did it, but all that had gone before. We gotta just chip, chip, chip away. And who knows when it'll happen, but one day that stone will crack. And when it does, make sure you're able to look at it and say, "I helped do that." This is the 31st episode of Being Jewish with me, Jonah Platt. My guest today and I have never met in person before, but we've been admirers of each other's work from afar since October 7th. As one of America's leading TV news anchors, she is tasked with the vital job of holding our most important public leaders accountable on our behalf, all while balancing the need for occupational neutrality while still honoring her own identity. She has been celebrated for her steadfast and outspoken support of the Jewish community and also publicly harassed for it, though she continues to represent us proudly and undeterred. She's a best-selling author, the grandchild of Holocaust survivors, and famously called the first Trump-Biden debate a shit show on live TV. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the stalwart Dana Bash.
Hi, Jonah.
Hi, Dana. Thank you so much for being here.
It's so great to be here. As I said to you, one of the many reasons I adore you is your name, because my son's name is Jonah. I have one son and he's Jonah. So
he's
you had me a Jonah.
That's very kind. He's a sweetheart.
We just FaceTimed before.
Yeah. I want to start by asking you this. You have a very public job. You're blonde. Mm-hmm. Are people always surprised to find out you're Jewish?
They are.
Right?
Yeah.
That before too. And
yeah.
I'm not nearly as public as you are.
Now, my maiden name is Schwartz.
That's a dead giveaway.
That would have been a giveaway.
So before we jump into all things, Dana, I want to get your take on something more topical.
Okay.
The Hamas-Israel war has resumed. How inevitable do you feel like that resumption was? And what's your read on the situation?
Maybe I'm naive. I don't necessarily think it was inevitable.
Really?
Remember, I preface that by saying, maybe I'm naive, mm-hmm. which I shouldn't be at this point. I mean, nobody should be. But there is and was such a determination to get to phase two of these negotiations by the Trump administration. I genuinely think by Israel and I guess less so by Hamas. We won't litigate here the reasons for the resumption in the war. It's just, as somebody who has, as I'm sure you have as well, spent time with the families of the hostages, including and especially those who are still there,
yeah.
the Alexander family.
Yeah.
I mean, I just saw them the night of the president's address to Congress. They were in the Capitol with their representative because they are from and they live in Tenafly, New Jersey with Josh Gottheimer. And there was so much hope mm-hmm. that we were going to get to phase two soon. And then there was that, I don't know if you remember, there was this brief report that came out that Hamas said, okay, we're going to release Adan Alexander
right.
and also some of the hostages who were killed. And then it just all went poof.
I feel it was inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
They were going to resume. I don't think the Israeli government had the appetite for phase two of,
mm-hmm.
you know, we're going to basically allow Hamas to continue on and leave before the jig is up.
Yeah, so, I know.
It's
look,
disappointing.
It's tough.
Yeah.
It's very tough.
Okay. So now let's talk about you. Your mom was a Jewish educator, is that
yes,
right?
Yes. Yeah. And so, she still is.
I mean, amazing. It's like, hello.
But you know what's really interesting about that? What she always wanted to do was adult Jewish education because she always said, and she's right, that particularly I grew up Reform,
mm-hmm.
that for Reform Jews, the adults on Sunday mornings and on Tuesday or Wednesday nights, they drop the kid off and then they pick them up and then that's it. Well, why not use that time for adult education for
yeah.
the parents, most of whom ended their Jewish education at age 13.
Right.
So that's why she got into it.
I love that. That's mm-hmm. all. We need more of that.
We do.
We've talked about that on this show before.
I know.
Sarah
yeah.
Hurwitz on.
By the way, I love Sarah Hurwitz.
She's amazing.
She's terrific.
Obviously, your parents were impactful in your life and the path that gone down. What do you admire most about them?
That's such a good question.
Yeah.
It's a hard one. And you're going to make me cry because I just love them so much. What I admire most about them is that they're just so normal. And as I've gotten older and made my way in the world, I've realized more and more how normal they are because most people are not. By normal, I mean down to earth, straight shooters. They believe that most people in the world are good. They do things the way that you're supposed to do them.
It's my wife's number one compliment is when she describes someone as normal.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Weekly shout out to Courtney.
Courtney, I'm totally with you. But there were times in my adult life where I actually think that hurt me because you wouldn't think this because of the business that I am, but maybe I was too trusting. Like, oh, that person is a malignant narcissist.
Right,
or
right.
Like, which I didn't even understand
totally
the concept of that because
yeah.
I was totally unfamiliar with it. They are all about our family. And that has come back to them because my family is very close. And I realize, again, as I get older, how rare that is.
So your mother's parents mm-hmm. were Holocaust survivors. Mm-hmm. How big of an influence did that have on your Jewish upbringing?
The biggest.
The biggest.
Did you guys were here, your family was here pre-Holocaust,
yes,
right?
My family came over right at the turn of the 20th century.
Right. So, but I know that you've talked to enough people to know that there were sort of two kinds of experiences. One is the experience where you have somebody in your family who experienced World War II in Europe, the Holocaust, and they never talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the experience, which is my experience, of they don't stop talking about it.
Wow.
Which I feel lucky that I had the latter experience. My grandmother was Hungarian. My grandfather was Austrian. So he had to leave Austria around Kristallnacht, which was like, you know, probably 4 years before they actually left Europe, 3 years before they left Europe. He didn't have papers. He was hiding. He was making his way. He told me all these incredible stories about the quote unquote gypsies helping him navigate the mountains so that he could get over to find my grandmother in Hungary. And he hid there with my grandmother's family because Hungary was fine until 1944, until it wasn't.
Right.
My grandfather's brother, my great uncle, Charles, was already in the United States. As soon as he saw things sort of rumbling in Vienna, he's like, I'm out.
Wow.
He was a chemist. My great grandfather had paint factories mm-hmm. in Vienna. They were, again, typical Western European Jews. Considered themselves good Austrians, were assimilated. They were, you know, Jewish, but had
integrated
Jewish identities, but very much integrated. They lived right on the Ringstrasse. And then when things started to change, you know, again, my great uncle was like, I'm out.
Good eye.
So he, and he took his talents as a chemist to Chicago, started working for a company run by a Jewish guy. And the guy just absolutely adored my great uncle. And so it got to the point where the other members of my grandfather's family who were already here, they were kind of tapped out on getting people over.
Mm-hmm.
My great grandparents on my grandfather's side got over and others. And so the boss of this, it was called American Decal, that was the company in Chicago, said, okay, I'll sign the affidavit for your brother and sister-in-law, my grandparents. Which was a huge deal back then because it was a lot of money.
Mm.
I think it was like $25,000 each, which
1940s money. That's huge.
Huge. And which was a big part of the subplot that, you know, we can get to, which is you could get here, but you had to pay for it.
Yeah.
And the whole FDR administration, Congress, the State Department, they were determined not to let the Jews in.
Yeah.
They made it very hard. Right before Pearl Harbor,
mm-hmm.
when Hitler knew that there was a lot of pressure on the U.S. to get into World War II and didn't want that, of course.
Right.
And there was a very narrow window where they thought that perhaps helping to accelerate the Jewish visas, the Jews who had the American visas to leave might help.
Mm.
Somehow, because of this, the Nazi Party allowed my Jewish grandparents to fly across Europe in the fall of 1941.
Wow.
To get to Spain. And then they got on a ship and they arrived. They saw the Statue of Liberty, Columbus Day, 1941, two months before Pearl Harbor, and then nothing would have happened.
Wow.
Meanwhile, my great grandparents, my grandmother's parents and sister, they stayed in Hungary. They're like, we're fine. We have a treaty with Hitler. Nothing's going to happen to us. Fast forward to 1944 when Hitler just blew through that treaty like he did all the others. And, they were rounded up and taken to Auschwitz and killed immediately.
Mm.
And my grandmother found out that her immediate family was all dead. Just a couple of, I think it was days after my mother was born in 1945. She was born September of 1945. And that was the point where they finally got a letter that her parents had written and it finally arrived in the U.S. effectively saying, you know, we're out of here.
Hey.
Yeah.
How was that all imparted to you?
I remember the bedtime stories where my grandfather would tell us about what their lives were like before, what their lives turned into. He was so proud of his story. He actually wrote his autobiography, which I have.
Oh, cool.
And my father actually, you know, kind of cleaned it up and self-published it, which is really, really special to have.
That's amazing.
And he took us to, in 1996, my brother, my parents, and I and my aunt went with my grandfather on what he called a sentimental journey. And we went to Vienna, we went to Hungary, we went to Bratislava where my grandparents met.
Wow.
And the whole time, Jonah, the entire time, what stuck with me is what he wanted to stick with me, which is for so long, it's not that they wanted to annihilate us. They wanted us to go away.
Right.
And no one would take us.
Yeah.
And no one would take us. I mean, mm-hmm. I just explained how hard it was to get to the U.S. There was no Israel. Some of his cousins were very active early on in getting refugees to Israel and became sort of early members of the modern Israeli government and those who helped set it up. But that was the most important thing that he told us.
Yeah. Before October 7th, mm-hmm. how did you try to uphold your family's legacy in the way that you move about the world?
I have always had a strong Jewish identity, but I think like so many Jews, it changed after October. I know you right. talk about it a lot on this show. I see your Jewish star mm-hmm. that was something that you started to wear proudly. You're not alone, obviously, in yeah. that, which is a good thing because I've done work at CNN on anti-Semitism, and yeah. that's one of the most important things is to not hide it.
Yeah.
Is to be loud and proud
totally.
And to normalize mm-hmm. the fact that we're Jewish because back to the word, I guess, of this podcast, it is normal.
Exactly. Yeah. yeah. You know?
Just remember going to Friday night services as a kid, lighting the candles. There were really indelible parts of my memory, but I was also a very assimilated kid in America. And I had a lot of friends who were Jewish. I had a lot of friends who weren't Jewish. I did go to Jewish camp.
Oh, nice.
Which is the ball game. Camp yeah. Harlem.
Camp what?
Camp Harlem. It's H-A-R-L-A-M.
Ah.
Named for Joseph and Betty Harlem. It's in the Poconos in Kunkeldown, Pennsylvania. And I went to Jewish camp because my mother went to Jewish camp in Wisconsin. And she's like, it changed my life. It'll change your life. You're going. And I said, okay, my brother, okay. And she was right. Then I sent my son, Jonah, to the same camp that my brother and I
Amazing.
Went to. Changed his life. And I've seen you talk about this, Jonah, about, what did you say? Go full Jew?
Yeah.
Where it's like, okay, to just sing the songs
yep.
and do the things. And you have all of the people around you doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So much of what I learned, all the music, the traditions, I mean, a lot of it I learned at home, but a lot of it was also at camp. Did you go to camp?
I did, yeah.
Okay.
And my mom went. So I went to the same camp that my mom
oh,
went
really?
To. And all my cousins and siblings, we all went together every summer.
I didn't think that the West Coast.
There's a Camp Ramah.
Oh,
it's a
okay.
big national
sure.
camp. And there's one in Ojai, California, like 80 minutes north of Los
Amazing.
Angeles.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, no camp.
But I didn't appreciate the immersion aspect of it until mm-hmm. I was older, sort of looking back on it, realizing, wow, that's like the only time in my life where I was from, you know, dawn to dusk in a Jewish majority.
It's the best. It's the absolute best. I will say that I don't talk about this very much, but I'm Dana Bash. My first husband, his name is Jeremy Bash.
Mm-hmm.
We're friends and he's the best guy in the world.
Great.
He grew up conservadox.
Uh-huh.
So his father is a conservative rabbi, but they were Shomer Shabbat. His mother's family was all modern Orthodox. Pretty much his father's family was modern Orthodox too. And so that combination, I mean, I kind of sometimes joke that it was a form of a mixed marriage because I had to learn so much that I didn't know. I mean,
yeah.
again, like Passover, all the holidays, but as you said, whether it was the long Kiddush or the short Kiddush,
right.
the Birkat Hamazon, which is the prayer you say after after you eat, I knew it, thank goodness, because of camp. But I just remember, you're probably too young. Do you remember what a Sony Walkman was?
Of course.
Okay.
Right. Yeah.
So I remember him, Jeremy sang the entire Haggadah, probably from memory.
Whoa.
From start to finish, as they do it in their house, which was, the Seder was hours and hours long.
Oh my God. All in Hebrew?
It was largely in Hebrew.
Wow.
And I used to jog with my Walkman to him singing the Haggadah to me so that I would, like, you know, get prepared for it. Aww. As I got ready for it. And so that experience, and I didn't grow up kosher.
Mm-hmm.
I had a kosher home with him, and I still have a kosher kitchen. Now, I will say that if I bring somebody who's really from into my house, I they would not consider it super glot.
Yeah.
But that's one thing that I've kept up. I've tried to keep it up. But I do it for me, and it's just something that is like a daily, regular reminder of who I am, and yeah. I love it.
That's amazing. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about your career. So you have been with CNN your whole career, which
literally
is amazing.
Or bananas.
I mean, to be in any industry, to be with one business the entire time, it's as rare these days.
It is.
I'm curious, like, how did you first break in?
Internships were not paid.
Right.
So my second semester, my senior year, I said, I think I'd like to get paid for something that I do. So
sure.
I called CNN, cold called.
Whoa.
To see if they needed any freelancers. And I, you know, talk about it's everything is timing. I got the guy who hired freelancers on the phone the day that he just got an earful from somebody because they couldn't take a vacation because there was no one to fill in for them because they didn't have anybody to do that job. And it was the feeds room, which is like coming in and pressing play and record on VHS, which,
okay,
again, look it up if you're listeners and don't understand what a VHS is.
So it's a more mature crowd here, I think.
Okay.
Most
all right,
people
good.
Are familiar.
All right, good. And I came in and I learned it and I started freelancing. And then when I graduated, a tape library position opened up. Again, something that doesn't exist anymore. There's no videotape, so there's no library. Mm-hmm. It's all digital. And I got it. So I got my first job at CNN on my 22nd birthday.
Wow.
And I've been at CNN ever since.
From the tape library to America's living room.
Yeah, well.
It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, so that's my story.
Did you always aspire to be an anchor?
No.
Like, no, not at all.
No, I didn't even know if I wanted to be an on-camera correspondent. I started out after the tape library working as an associate producer and a producer on programs, mm-hmm, on our weekend public affairs shows, which weirdly, I am a co-anchor of one of the versions of those shows that I started on now all these years later.
Cool.
I liked it. I mean, I got great experience. I worked with top-notch anchors, understanding how questions are asked because it's all about the interview shows.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just decided that I wanted to try news gathering. So I took a lateral move. I went to the assignment desk and I worked there and helped, again, worked with reporters, worked with producers, started going out in the field. And then the Clinton impeachment trial happened,
mm-hmm,
and was all hands on deck. And I went up to Capitol Hill during that trial and just to help out. And I was like, oh my God, this is amazing.
This is cool.
This is cool. Because like you get to run around and talk to senators, talk to House members, talk to their staff. And really, you have a primary interaction and experience with the news as it is happening. So I loved it. And I started to report on news, break news. And they were like, you want to try doing it on camera? And I said, no, because
really?
I knew enough at that point to know starting at that level was really dangerous. And I was right because I was really awful. My first live shot in my life was the White House lawn.
That's cool. No,
it was cool, but it was terrifying and it was terrible.
Yeah, you weren't ready for it.
All the tease. Yeah, no. But then, you know, they stuck with me. I stuck with it and went back to Capitol Hill, which was my first love, and covered Congress and campaigns. And
we've covered a lot of election stuff.
A lot. Mostly that's what I do.
That's kind of your thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Even your recent best-selling book is about an election, not a recent one, actually one from 1872.
Mm-hmm.
What the hell made you write a book about an 1872 Louisiana election?
I mean, doesn't everybody want to write about an 1872?
I mean,
the election of 1872 in Louisiana was a gubernatorial election. It was so messed up, genuinely messed up, not like fake messed up.
Right, right.
There was no clear winner because the voting was, it was right after the Civil War, and the whites in the South realized that by that point that the best way to hold on to power is to rig an election.
Right.
And to suppress the black vote. And so totally messed up. Nobody would concede. For a while, there were two governors, two slates of legislatures, two judges, like sets of judges. It was a complete mess. And when the problems that I just described in Louisiana also happened in several other southern states, to the point where when the electors and the sort of slates of votes got to Congress to certify the election, they couldn't do it. From these four states, they had to throw the votes out.
Wow.
And then it came up, they came up with a deal, and it was literally a backroom deal that allowed President Rutherford Hayes to be elected. And then what ended up happening, long story short, is part of that deal was they pulled the troops out of the South and said, you're on your own. The federal government is no longer involved in elections, which allowed for Jim Crow to take effect for 100 years in the South. And so because it's, you know, obviously politically relevant, it was about politics, it was about elections, and we wanted to do it before the 2024 election, not knowing what was going to happen. And it was really interesting to learn about that.
You've moderated a number of debates, which is really cool. Can you think of a proudest presidential debate moment?
June 2024 debate was an interesting moment. I wouldn't say it was necessarily proudest. Even, I mean, I'm proud of the way we handled the debate. Mm-hmm. It was not what we expected. It obviously was one of the most monumental, if not the most monumental since Kennedy Nixon in terms of changing the course of the election.
Yeah.
And that had nothing to do with us. That was just about the candidates or the candidate.
What was that like in real time watching, you know, President Biden falter in that way?
It was stunning. It was stunning because what you do, of course, before the debate, particularly something as high stakes as this, is we have an amazing team. We practice, we go through, we do mock debates with a fine-tooth comb every scenario of what could happen so that we're not surprised. We were surprised.
Yeah.
Wow. We were definitely surprised. And so there was a lot of, I mean, luckily we do live TV a lot.
Sure.
So
you know how to roll with
there
the punches.
There was some rolling with the punches, but it was definitely not what we expected in the least.
I mean, did you guys come off set and you were like, holy shit, that was crazy.
Yeah. I mean, we kind of did it on set.
Right.
Like, I've obviously since watched some of it. And I do think it was much more pronounced for people at home because we were in, there was no audience. So we were in a studio and we were not like in their faces, but we were obviously pulled back and we had the whole stage.
Right. Camera puts you right in somebody's face.
And the camera puts you, and not only does the camera put you in somebody's face, it was the side by side.
Right.
So you have Trump sort of looking to his left where Biden was, and Biden, instead of looking at us, which we were to his right, or at Trump, also to his right, oftentimes was looking to his left, and there was nobody and nothing there.
Yeah.
Which I think made the experience for the viewers even more intense than for the two of us sitting there, Jake Tapper and I.
Monumental, for sure. I do want to get into some October 7th stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Where were you when you found out what was going on, and how quickly did you get from wherever that was into covering it live on television?
I was home. I woke up on Saturday morning. I looked at my phone. And I think like so many people, at first, you know, it obviously took a second, more than a second, to really absorb that this isn't just, oh, shoot, something bad's happening in Israel.
Right.
That this is
different.
The thing
yeah.
happening in Israel. And so I got up, I got dressed, I ran into the office. And everybody was already, the CNN teams globally, we were already scrambling to figure out what's what. And at some point, they put me in the anchor chair and I was anchoring for a few hours during the day. It was surreal. I mean, it's honestly kind of a blur to me.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, I should go back and watch it. But yeah, it was because just getting the information real time for everybody was astonishing. But trying to help make sense of it on the air and make sure we had the right people and the right information and the right framing and the right perspective was the most important thing.
Can you like let us behind the curtain a little bit and try to explain to us what it's like, you know, covering a breaking news mm-hmm. event? Like what is going on that we're not seeing? What's in your ear?
Yeah,
what's
a lot.
The process?
Most of the time you'll go into the show if it's really breaking news and it's rolling coverage. Usually there are minimal scripts because things are changing on the fly. And you have your laptop, you have your information, you're texting your sources, and you're seeing what your colleagues are reporting in real time.
So you're gathering your own news as you're—
I try to. Mm-hmm. It's not always easy when you're also anchoring.
Yeah.
And they'll say, okay, we have this person available. We have that person available. And just, you just kind of have to go and go with your gut about what to ask, because in those moments, it's truly who, what, where, when, why. I mean, it's the basics
right.
about knowing the facts, which were coming in fast and furious. And of course, I have an amazing team, and one of my producers came in just to help give me background and information on whomever I was going to talk to next quickly. But it's, you roll with it. And what I have learned over the years is transparency with the audience, that sometimes the satellite's going to go down. Sometimes I'm going to go to somebody and I think it's person X, but it's person Y. And you just say, you know, sorry, everybody, it's live television. You see what's happening as I do. And I think that gives a little bit of grace.
Yeah, for sure.
And people get it.
Yeah.
People get that stuff's happening fast.
Mm-hmm.
And having a strong producer in your ear is the ballgame.
What is it that they're doing to guide you?
They're seeing things that we can't see.
Mm-hmm.
First and foremost, they know who's coming up and who's available, because they're just, even from a CNN reporter point of view, they know that Nick Robertson just landed in the Tel Aviv airport and that he is trying to, he's like basically undercover on the tarmac at Ben Gurion, trying to get information about what's going on, and he can call in.
Well,
so I didn't know that Nick Robertson had just landed,
right.
things like that. You have to have a level of trust that this is something that you can do on the air, and you just go to it. And again, sometimes Nick Robertson wasn't there because
right.
he had to turn his phone off because there was incoming or whatever was happening. And then the whole news organization is set up in such a way that there's a process through which the people in the control room and the people who are writing online, they know when something is ready for air or ready for publishing. And it's days like that where those processes are really, like, we just kick into high gear.
Yeah. How challenging is it to balance your responsibilities as a Jewish woman, as a reporter, all at once?
This isn't just a company line.
Yeah.
And I know, because I've been at CNN for more than 30 years. We are one of the last bastions. I truly believe this in my heart of hearts. As a broadcast network, a television network, that our, where our goal truly is objective journalism.
So,
truly is.
So how does it feel to, I mean, I don't know how much you
yeah.
feel this, but you know, that's not the perception from
yeah, it sucks.
The public. It must
yeah.
be shitty if you're, you know, you're in there.
It is.
Really working towards that
yeah.
and people are just writing it off.
Part of the issue is that, particularly when Fox News came on the scene, I started at CNN before Fox existed,
mm-hmm.
before MSNBC existed, but particularly Fox. Look, the reason why Fox was created and why Roger Ailes wanted a Fox News, Rupert Murdoch wanted a Fox News, is because they believe that people who go into journalism are, by definition, lefties.
Right.
And they wanted a place where there was a kind of like the conservative radio of television.
Right.
And it worked, you know, and there was an appetite for that. But that is truly a conservative media outlet.
Right.
And now it's MAGA and MAGA slash conservative, and it all kind of blends together in many ways now. And like, that's okay. They're unabashed about it. They're very upfront about it. MSNBC at night particularly, they're very upfront about who they are and what they want to be. I think because of the contrast, there are lots of reasons why we're not perceived as middle of the road. Right now, we're kind of back to where we should be. But particularly with the beginning of the Trump years, it was such a sort of shock to the system of journalism, to be in a position where you had a president who was not telling the truth.
Yeah.
And when they were not telling the truth and doing so on live TV, to have to come out and correct him or to tell your viewers this isn't right or that's a lie, which, I mean, the notion of me using the L word about a president pre 10 years ago, like, I couldn't even imagine that that is something that I would ever do.
Right.
And so by being pro-truth and pro-facts, we were perceived as being anti-Trump and anti-Republican.
Right.
And that's the current state of things.
How confident are you when you're sitting down to speak mm-hmm. that the information you've been given is authentic and bulletproof?
Really good question. You can never be 100% confident. I mean, it depends on kind of the flavor of the information. If somebody is saying something to you, like if you, Jonah Platt, said to me, today the sky is blue, and I go on television and say, according to Jonah Platt, the sky is blue, like,
that's pretty safe.
It's on the record.
Yeah.
If you, as a podcast host, tell me that the sky is blue, and I go on television and say, according to a podcast host, the sky is blue, then I'm on less firm ground, so I better be even more sure. Now, if somebody tells me something that is incorrect, even if they do it on the record, I'm not going to use it if I know it's incorrect.
Right.
Point being, especially when you have sources who don't want to use their names, it's important if you can to get more than one source.
Right.
To corroborate. Also, as much as we can, give context to why we're getting that information, to kind of explain to the viewers maybe not who it's coming from, but where it's coming from and why. But we get burned. And the most important thing, and the difference between those of us who are still in the business of trying to get it right and striving for accuracy and objective journalism, is when we don't get it right, we own up to it so that there's transparency.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is a reason why in every newspaper in America, there's a corrections page.
I feel like the Israel-Gaza war in particular has been really difficult to get right a lot of the time because
it's an information war as much as maybe even more. I mean, I'm not belittling the fact that it's a war and people are dying, but the war for information is huge.
I feel like it's been especially tough because people who you, or at least as a society that we typically think of as being reliable, are not necessarily in this case, like the UN or NGOs or the Red Cross or whatever it might be. How have you, you know, and your team tried to deal with that? And, you know, specifically, I'll ask, the way that the Hamas data is often reported, not necessarily by you, but in general in the media, at sort of at face value with no qualification, how do you handle that?
It's a challenge. The information that is coming from Gaza is largely coming from sort of the Hamas, the Palestinian Foreign Ministry. What we say is the Palestinian Foreign Ministry, which is controlled by Hamas. In order to, again, it's the transparency thing.
Yeah.
I think that's the most important thing because most Western journalists are not on the ground. It's very difficult to get there and to report on it with the sort of primary sources. But there's no other way to say it is that it's really hard, Jonah.
What has it meant in this time to have Jewish colleagues like Jake Tapper and Wolf Blitzer around you during this, you know, difficult 18 plus months period?
You know what? It's so funny. I never thought about it before October 7th.
Right. Right. I don't think that's funny. I feel like that's a lot of people would have that similar experience in whatever their job was.
I think it's not that different than as you said, with any profession that you're in, any social setting that you're in, any educational setting that you're in, there is a comfort, no matter who you are, with finding your people, mm-hmm. no matter what your religious background, ethnic background, as much as we are hoping to be integrated and it's fascinating and important to know people from different walks of life, there is something about knowing that other people get who you are and where you come from and maybe what's going on in your heart.
Yeah.
Not through the prism of news at all, just like as a human being and as a colleague.
Totally. It makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
In 2022, well before October 7th, you did a special at CNN called Rising Hate, Anti-Semitism in America. What did you learn about Jew hate in America while putting that show together? And how, if at all, is what you saw then different than what we're seeing now?
When I did that special, it was because we were seeing
huge rise in
anti-Semitism, as you said, well before October 7th, 2023. And most of the egregious Jew hate was coming from the hard right, the extreme right. It was the Tree of Life shooting. It was Poway in California, here mm-hmm. in California.
Coleyville,
exactly. And those were radicalized people on the hard right mm-hmm. who were learning about Jew hate and Nazi propaganda online and through other sources. And I made a point of saying at the time, I don't want to just do it from the right, even though that's where the actual violence is coming from back then. There is something bubbling in a pretty big way on the far left that's happening in college campuses, and I don't want to lose sight of that. And so we found and we talked to a college student from one of the SUNY schools who was, and now this is going to be as familiar as anything right now.
Yeah.
But at the time, I was really blown away to hear that she was a proud progressive. She was a survivor of sexual assault, helped start a survivor of sexual assault group on campus. And she was kicked out of the group that she founded because she posted online that she supports Israel. And this, I think, happened maybe 2021, 2022. And she felt so unsafe at school after that, that she ended up coming home.
Wow.
And the school administration said, we're not getting involved in politics.
Politics.
She told the story of, obviously, what ended up being so widespread, so vast, and it absolutely exploded with the alliances all shifting before our eyes, the political alliances, particularly for Jews, shifting before our eyes in a way that was really monumental after October 7th, but it was already there. Because the notion of these Jewish students who were, again, so proudly progressive, being shunned by their fellow progressives, being told that you can't support Israel because they're occupiers, they're colonizers, the apartheid, all of the tropes. Now, what we did at the time was we talked to Jonathan Greenblatt with ADL. He was part of that documentary. And the way he described it at the time, I will never forget, which is anti-Semitism on the right, it's like climate change. Anti-Semitism on the right is like the tsunami's hitting you, the hurricane's hitting you, the pick your natural disaster that's hitting you because it was so aggressive and violent. Anti-Semitism on the left is like, you know that the climate is changing. It's just that you don't feel the effects of it yet.
Right.
And then October 7th happened. Was lucky that I was allowed to and able to do a second hour right after October 7th. Before October 7th and that first hour, it took like 6 months to do it, to really line up all the stories and get people. Afterwards, it took a week, not even.
Because there was just a wealth of stories.
A flood of stories in a horrible way.
Right. In the press coverage for that special, you talked about how your son was wearing a Jewish star necklace of the pride in his identity. Mm-hmm. How has that pride changed, if at all, for you and your family since October 7th?
This is going to sound like a cop out of an answer, Jonah, but I've genuinely always been a proud Jew. And I think that is because of not just my mom and my dad, but my grandfather.
Sure.
And a proud American Jew.
Yeah.
One of my big takeaways from my grandfather was how much he loved being an American. Mm-hmm. And you hear that from immigrants from all walks of life, totally. From all countries, but particularly somebody who fled Hitler.
Right.
He loved being an American. He loved the 4th of July. Loved it, loved it, loved it. And this is still the greatest country in the world.
Yeah.
But I do often wonder what he would be thinking about now. History is nowhere near repeating itself. I don't even think it's rhyming yet.
Really?
Not yet. I don't, because I think we have to be clear-eyed about it. Mm-hmm. But I do think about him living this comfortable life in a very comfortable society where he was so knowledgeable about the arts and books and culture and things that have nothing to do with Judaism. And all of a sudden being told, you're a Jew, you don't get to do any of that here because you're a Jew and that's all that matters. To see some of the Jew hate, the absolute Jew hate on the streets of this country that he loved, you know, it just breaks my heart to think about it. And I do feel an obligation as a Jew, not as a journalist, but as a Jew and as a daughter of people who escaped so that they could survive, procreate, but that so the Jewish people could survive.
A responsibility to do what?
Keep the flame going. You know, yeah. One of my favorite sayings in Judaism is L'dor v'dor, because it's all we have.
Yeah.
I mean, if we didn't have from generation to generation, then we wouldn't exist. And to keep that going is such a responsibility, but it's also something that I find so valuable. And I feel so lucky to be born Jewish, to have this part of my life and this part of my identity of who I am, to continue that as a member of the Jewish community. And again, as a Jewish parent, it's so special to me.
It's beautiful. Looking around today, how do you feel about the state of the Democratic Party?
Well, I will tell you from a reporter's perspective about how the American people think of the Democratic Party. And that is, CNN just had a poll this past week that it's got an all-time low approval, mm-hmm. like 20%.
Wow.
It's not great.
And is that something like within the news world that like you're all aware of and about? We're like, this is wild. Like,
yeah,
what's going
and you know
on
who
here?
Else is aware of it? The Democratic leaders.
Are they?
And elected. Oh, yeah. There's a huge soul searching going on right now among elected officials, both in Washington, governors around the country, legislators, county officials. I mean, everybody trying to figure out what went wrong. And when I say what went wrong, it's not just about losing the election or losing the election to Donald Trump. It's about the voters the Democrats have lost. Mm-hmm. But there's not consensus about what to do about it. There is, just like in the Republican Party, there is kind of the more populist, you know, John Fetterman, senator from Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. or frankly, even AOC. She's as progressive as they come, but she also has a populist sensibility.
Right.
There's a very big strain of populism in the Republican Party, sure. which is how they got a lot of the formerly Democratic voters, particularly rural voters, working class voters, even some middle class voters. And so trying to find their way, I'm just talking about the Democrats now, and figure out why is it that we are the most popular in urban areas? Mm-hmm. Why is it that we're the most popular among the highly educated? I think, honestly, it's at this point, it's the educational divide, even as much or even more than the geographical divide.
Do you think that speaks to the economic, socioeconomic divide?
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm. I do. And it's the perception of elitism.
Yeah.
That bluntly people feel left behind. And from the beginning, that's what Donald Trump, that was his whole message. It was very simple. You feel left behind. I see you. I hear you. Come with me. And that was amplified in 2024 when, even though the economic indicators and the numbers and what you look at if you're an economist were getting much better under Joe Biden, mm-hmm. inflation was high and people didn't feel it. And if you can't buy a house, if you can't pay a mortgage, if you can't afford the groceries that you used to afford, you're going to be pissed.
Yeah.
And you're going to want to throw the bums out. And you know what's really interesting, Jonah, is that post-COVID, the economy was so bad globally,
right,
that in democracies across the world, whether they were left-leaning leaders or more right-leaning or center-right-leaning leaders, more of those leaders were thrown out by their people than I think at almost any point in recorded history.
Yeah.
And it wasn't necessarily because it was a right or left issue. It was an anger issue right. at the government isn't doing what I need it to be doing for me.
Okay, so that's your survey of the Democrats. What okay. about the Republicans? What are you seeing in the first couple months of Trump 2.0 that you are impressed by? And what mm-hmm. are you seeing that you are worried by?
The big difference within the Republican Party is that the first time around, there were a lot of people in Congress who were skeptical of him, who didn't want to go along with him, who bucked him. And some of them lost their primaries mm-hmm. and they got penalized by Republican voters. In fact, most of them did, but they still existed and they made it harder for Trump to do the things he wanted to do. Now, at this point, either those people are long gone because they were forced to retire or they got primaried and they lost from a fellow Republican who was more Trumpy,
mm-hmm.
or they're just sucking it up and closing their mouth.
Yeah.
Or in some cases, they're now part of his administration.
Right.
And that is really the big difference. The quote unquote resistance was in effect among Republicans back then, and it's not now. And what this means is that the Republican Party is now the Trump Party.
Yeah. I'm going to jump into our lightning round, which okay. we like to finish the show on. Couple of easier questions than the ones I've been tossing at you so far. Yeah. Which past president do you wish you'd had the opportunity to interview and why?
I wish I would have been able to interview FDR and I would ask him, you were such a great president. You did so many amazing things. Why didn't you do more for the Jews?
Mm.
That's a personal one for me.
Yeah.
He defeated Hitler, so he did well.
That was important.
But I'm talking about during the war.
Right.
Why didn't they knew.
Right.
Why didn't they bomb the train tracks? Why right. didn't they?
Why were they so focused on the military victories and not helping at the same time?
Yeah. And letting more people in to America.
Right. Right. If you could interview one person from Jewish history, who would it be and why?
Esther.
Oh, it was quick on that one.
I mean, can you think of a badass woman in the history of the Jewish people than Esther?
So my wife loves Vashti from the Purim
Vashti's
story.
Vashti's good. I like Vashti.
Vashti was like, I'm not going to be your, you know, little yep. piece or whatever. I'm out of here.
Yeah.
And she likes that.
I like that too.
Yeah. Favorite Jewish holiday?
I think Seder.
Yeah.
I think Passover. Mostly because going back to the family, it's when we all get together mm-hmm. and it's such a special time and you do read a history book.
Yeah. Okay, last question. Do you have any final parting words of wisdom or call to action for our listeners and viewers out there?
I would say, if you are Jewish, what did you say? Let your freak flag fly? What is that what
that's
you
a
say?
Thing.
Yeah, like let it fly, like be comfortable, it's okay. And if you're not Jewish, and for some reason you are listening to a podcast called Being Jewish.
We got a lot of non-Jewish listeners in this community.
Be an ally.
Yeah.
Call your Jewish friends, send them a text, and just say, hey, you know, just checking in. That goes, did you have this experience? That goes so far.
It's like the greatest hug in the world.
I actually never expected to feel that way.
Yeah.
To be in a And you know, I know you had Sheryl Sandberg on. I'm not a crier. And to this day, every time I hear her talk about the walk that she took with her friend who's not Jewish, and she said, "Will you hide me?"
Yeah.
And her friend was taken aback, and then it said, "Of course," and they cried. You know, that kind of connection with somebody who isn't Jewish, who has made who can never live it, but who is made to understand the depth of the pain that a lot of Jewish people are in. Forget about Israel,
yeah.
Forget about the war, but to be an American Jew right now, I never thought I would feel as comforted as I have by just those random texts that I've gotten from non-Jewish friends.
I totally relate.
Yeah.
Completely. Dana, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Oh my gosh.
Such
thank
a pleasure.
Thank you for reaching out. It's awesome to get the chance to interview the interviewer.
I know. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks once again to Dana Bash for letting me be the interviewer today. That was pretty darn cool. Thanks to my amazing team here at Being Jewish with Jonah Platt for hustling to get this episode together. I appreciate you. And thanks to all of you for continuing to support and grow the show. Please subscribe to the pod on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your pods. And if you've only ever listened, try watching us on youtube.com/@beingjewishpodcast. Totally different experience. All right, that's it. I'll see y'all back here for the next show-stopping episode of Being Jewish with me, Jonah Platt.
Big ups to everyone who makes this show possible every week. My executive producer, Matthew Jones, story producer, Sean Liviashvili, and editor, Mike O'Brien of Rainbow Creative. Consulting producer Bethany Mandel, research associate Samantha Greenwald, my amazing executive assistant Josie Rothschild, social media manager Yuval Yosha, and graphic designer extraordinaire Noah Bell. Most of all, thanks to you, dear listeners, who even stuck around to listen to all these credits. Man, I freaking love you guys.